Because in the end, banking is about trust. So although we love the technology and although we see the potential, we would never betray the trust-based relationship we have with our clients to push technology for the sake of pushing technology.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of In Check with FinTech by PCN, where we interview CEOs, founders, and executives from the FinTech space about their personal experiences, their companies, market trends, industry insights, and more. Today, we have the absolute honor to be joined by Edwin van Bommel, Chief Strategy and Innovation Officer at ABN AMRO. Edwin has over 20 years of experience in digital strategy, digital transformation, user experience design, advanced analytics, and artificial intelligence in financial institutions. In his current role at ABN AMRO, he leads the creation of groundbreaking products and services scaling the adoption of artificial intelligence through the organization, steering corporate development, and investing in premier startups worldwide. Before ABN AMRO, Edwin worked at IPsoft as the global CEO of its artificial intelligence platform Amelia, and before that for 16 years at McKinsey & Company, where he was one of the founding partners of Digital McKinsey. Enjoy listening!
Well, Edwin, great to be here at the ABN headquarters in Amsterdam. Thanks for being on the show, first of all.
Yeah, well, you're more than welcome. Happy to have you here. Yeah.
You're obviously now, for those who don't know, but will definitely know after this podcast, you're now the Chief Strategy and Innovation Officer at ABN, which we'll dive into a bit more about that role and what you're doing at the moment. But let's maybe start at the beginning of your career. You started as a business architect at PanFox.
Yes.
How did that come about?
How did that came about? Well, actually, it was a very logical step after my studies. I studied both business economics as well as management information systems, which was a bit at the crossroads of technology and business. And funnily enough, I already knew quite early in my life, I can't recall exactly at what age, but quite early in my life at high school, that I really wanted to have this combination of technology and business application. I was a bit of a nerd. I liked programming and doing that also with a couple of friends, but I also knew that programming was not totally my destination as well. But I was fascinated already then with what you could do on a computer. So I had the older generations, I had what was called a Philips MSX computer. So that came just after the Commodore 64, which many people know. But I was able to draw with it. I could draw cars with it. I could make beautiful things with it and very simple type of applications. And that sort of got my mind triggered. So when I then went to look for a university, I was looking for a study where I could learn to program a bit, but also I would learn how organizations actually work. And from there, the step to become more an IP business architect was a very logical step. And my first role within PanFox was actually at the tax authorities. Mm. And I was called a data specialist. And my friends thought I had the most boring job ever, right? Because being a data specialist at that time was just totally not sexy. People didn't get it, etc. So, but honestly, I'm happy that that was my first role, because I did that for the first year, 1.5 years in a huge project. And I really understood the importance of having clear data definitions, having the very high quality data, that you need to be able to exchange data between systems, because that was what I was designing and also testing. And until the current day and age, I really have benefits from that very, very first role.
All right. Well, yeah. Curious to learn bit more how that data has then influenced you moving forward. So there's data points, but maybe first, what kind of data points do you have access to in 1995 with the tax authorities?
The project we were doing was to create, what we would call now a CRM system. So basically what we did was for small, mid-sized enterprises, and later on I did actually the large corporate migration as well, to create one view of the customer. So if you would be an entrepreneur, or you would have a small corporate, we actually could see all the different types of taxation you would have. So income taxation, you would have the more the commercial taxation, you would have, etc. So that there would be one view, so that the tax authorities could be much more focused on you as a whole company instead of looking at slivers of your taxation. That was actually the system we built. At that time, there was no Salesforce yet, no Siebel yet. So we basically built it by now, I assume, I don't know, that they have replaced it with some standard software.
So it was the early days of data storage, yep. Basically, yep. Back then.
Yep.
You did that for about 4 years and then you went to McKinsey, yep. As a consultant.
Yep.
What made you, was it a logical step for you? Was it something that came about or did you always have to kind of ambition to become and go to McKinsey as a consultant at some point?
But funnily enough was that when I was a student somewhere in the middle of the trajectory at university, at one moment I saw a presentation by McKinsey on one of these big job fairs. And I was like, wow, this is really a fantastic company. I would love one day to work there. But funnily enough, when I came on the job market was extremely tight. And at that time, I actually didn't pop up even to send a letter to Amsterdam, to the McKinsey office. But I was way more pragmatic on let's secure a job because it was very hard, believe it or not, for someone in technology to get a job at that time. So I spoke with a couple of companies and then I actually selected Benflux because they had this great development program for young people doing similar studies like I've done. And I still have a couple of friends, which I learned to get to know there, who did similar trajectories. And then when I was a bit further in my career, at Benflux, actually two things happened. The first one was I more and more got roles which were more at the forefront of, okay, let's look at your strategy and let's translate that into what are the IT needs. And I really, really love that. And then the second thing was also that I was working at that in my last gig for a client where I was more or less starting to be and responsible for the whole project. And I like that as well. And in the beginning, actually didn't go very well. So I can remember that after a week or two, our job was to design the target architecture for that business unit. And after 2 or 3 weeks, I came in with the first deliverables with the CEO of the business unit and who was looking at it and said, look, I don't think this is adding any value to what we're doing here. So what is this? And I was just following the handbook of how we did these things, but I forgot actually to listen to what their real needs were. So basically at the moment I had to improvise and I said, okay, let's put this aside and not tell me now exactly what the problem is. What are your challenges? And I will adapt our approach to really solve this. In the end, we were able to turn it around. And honestly, when I left for McKinsey, it was also the end of this project. I almost got a warmer goodbye party from my client than from Benflux. So both were great parties, but they really regretted that I was changing jobs because I became an instrumental translator for them for their business strategy to the IT solution. But it gave me also the confirmation that that was actually the type of impact I wanted to have more and more at scale. And for me at that moment, McKinsey was a very, very logical step. The way I thought about McKinsey was very simple. There was a huge one-page ad in one of the newspapers. And they were looking for people who wanted to do strategy, but who also understood technology, because it was the start of the business technology practice in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. And this is how I ended up there. When I got the job, I thought I would stay there for 2 to 3 years, given the lifestyle, right, given the personal impact. But I enjoyed it so much that I stayed there for 16 years.
Yeah, you became a partner. I think yep. You co-founded McKinsey Digital.
Yes, yep.
Which I think is a testament to you, what you said in your words, being at the forefront of kind of that technological development, mm-hmm. right? Over those 17 years at McKinsey, so you departed there in 2016.
Yep.
Fintech was just around. I'm trying to think what else were your major developments in 2016. But when you started, at least in 1999, just before the internet boom.
Yep.
Did you envision back then the scale at which internet would take over the world? Was that something that you saw coming at that time? Do you still remember?
I remember. And honestly, I saw it for coming a bit, but not at the scale it took off. Right. So if you look at those old projections, we would make as a consulting firm, and the others had the same type of projections. In the end, you saw that it was slower than everyone anticipated, but in terms of impact, way, way bigger than anyone anticipated as well. But it was at that moment still hard to see because not all the developments were yet clear. So I'll give you an example. In my second engagement, we were doing a digital strategy actually for a media company. But at that moment, there was still no iPhone or Samsung phone. So the mobile phones, as we know, the smartphones were not there.
Mm-hmm.
So then basically we had to look at, okay, news on a mobile phone. It was with a technology called WAP. It was, if I show it to you, it was a small green screen on which you had to read your news. And that was just so impractical that when we tested it, we said, oh, this will never take off, not knowing that there would be an iPhone in the future. So even if you were then looking at, okay, how can we be at the forefront of digital, the technology limitations were much bigger than they are now. And I think that was one of the reasons. I think there were a couple of shocks in the system by these type of developments, which really have pushed it forward.
So fast forward to kind of the end of your time at McKinsey. You've been there for 17 years. What then? I mean, if you've been a partner at McKinsey, you've kind of seen a lot of things.
Right? Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. They're also, the thing which I saw at that moment was, at the end, when I was at Digital McKinsey, I was leading one of the products we had. And the product was all about, the internal name was Revenue Announcement for Digital Red. And it was, how can we leverage data so that our clients can become much more personal towards their clients, towards consumers? And we were at that moment doing this with all kinds of data analytics, modeling, and based on that, translating that quickly into micro campaigns and very simple algorithms. And one of the projects I did was for a foreign bank to do dynamic bannering on their online banking environment. So if you would log in, you would get much more personalized messages, which was at that time really, really unique.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the type of things I was doing. Now, this was very much possible by doing this with online bannering, by doing this in outbound call center campaigns, all these type of things. But where there was still a limitation was I wanted to have also the flows of how your app would respond to you also much more personalized. And that was still extremely hard because those structures are not super versatile. Obviously, you can have maybe two or three alternatives, but on a micro segment level, this was not possible. And then I saw AI and I saw chatbots, and I was like, this could be the solution. This could actually be the answer to this need to become even more personalized. So when I was working within McKinsey, I was thinking more and more about AI and the application of AI, especially with chatbots and the analytics to steer the chatbot. And then I met the people who were running Amelia and IPsoft, and I was just in the beginning starting to help them. And for people who don't know Amelia is a chatbot. And I was just helping them, advising them. There was a partnership between McKinsey and Amelia. But more and more, I got intrigued by the product. And apparently also I did something well to them because one moment I said, I need to be in New York. And I said, oh, maybe you should meet our founder.
Mm.
And what I thought, what would be a 30-minute meeting or so became a meeting of three and a half hours. Because we had a very great connection in the beginning. We talked a bit about AI in general. Then he showed me the product. And then halfway during the conversation, he actually asked me, Edwin, do you want to stay in your comfortable McKinsey life? Or do you want to join us? And in the end, I joined IPsoft, became the leader of Amelia. So, which was a huge step. But that was the background. It was exactly the right thing for me at the right moment. For a need which I saw.
It connected your interests
yep.
as well by the sounds of things, right?
Yep.
More personalization,
yep.
data, technology,
yep.
innovation.
Absolutely.
Amelia has won several awards. I think, was that in the time that you were there? Were you responsible for those awards with your team, or what was kind of your involvement in that?
Yeah, so basically what I did was, my official role was the chief cognitive officer, but it was, right, we had a company called IPsoft, and there were two main products. One was IP Center, and the other one was Amelia, and this was a title for the one leading Amelia. But more or less, I did the product development, all the implementations. We had a general sales force, but I was steering the sales force and all the deals for Amelia. So in general, everything except designing the core brain was in my merits. And designing the core brain, that was actually what Jayton was doing as a former assistant professor in math. He really knew how to translate abstract literature about AI into the concrete algorithms with our R&D team. And it was, winning those prizes was a joint effort. And I think what we did extremely well was, on one hand, that we were really ahead of our times in terms of the algorithms. We even had a module, which is a little bit Gen AI-ish, I would say, but not at the scale in which it was trained now by OpenAI, for instance, but at least putting in a document and then being able to answer questions about the document that was already in a module in Amelia, but it was not product ready yet. So we could not implement it, but at least we could show, hey, this is the future. And we were implementing most of the other modules. We were really state of art. What my role was with my team was to make sure that we were doing the right use cases. So what I really have learned is two things: picking the right use cases, and then make sure that you really manage them on impact.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds maybe more abstract than I mean, but the right use cases was, there were, first, if you were looking at IBM Watson, they were very much focusing on, for instance, healthcare and curing all kinds of diseases, which is extremely hard from a data perspective, but also the frequency of how many times a doctor actually will look at these things. Now, contrast that with incoming calls in a call center, which are on a daily basis, very repetitive, where 80% is always about the same topic. And we were very good in selecting those use cases which had more the characteristics of the second category. And why? Because there was more data. This was still at the time that the algorithms needed quite a lot of data to be trained. So this, we knew this was the ideal situation to make AI productive. And then the second thing was managing all impact is, if you have something like a chatbot, you want to make sure that there's something which we were calling a call deflection. So that meant that a chatbot needed to have a wide understanding, and after the right understanding, also give the right answers. And there were just generic answers, but preferably also execute processes. So if you take a bank, there's a lot of calls about, I lost my debit card. Okay, then understanding that case, but we were actually not able to say, oh, you have to go to this website and there you can find a link, or you have to call this call center. Amelia was actually able to then really block the card and make sure you would get your new card in the process. And this is how we really had very significant call deflection numbers. And the combination of the two made that we had quite a few clients where we had measurable impact and who were then willing to stand on the stage and talk with analysts. And this is in the end then how you win the awards, is because the analysts want to see real use cases with generated impact in these.
That's going from chatbot to AI, basically, right?
Yeah, and we had quite, especially in the later releases, we had quite a few AI elements in the chatbot, more than what people sometimes still see.
Yeah, exactly.
Talking with the chatbot. Yeah.
So chatbot, AI, just trying to get a red thread through this, going to now Gen AI.
Yep.
Your current role at ABN. I think you do more than Gen AI, but we'll talk about that Gen AI specifically after this, maybe in a couple of lines. Your current role at ABN, Chief Strategy Innovation Officer, you've been there 5.5 years.
Yep. You've
been here for 5.5 years because we're at your office in the end. What are you responsible for right now? Because innovation is broad, obviously, I guess innovation of the bank, but what are you particularly looking at the moment?
So the strategy part consists of two things, which is really our group strategy. as well as also our corporate development department. And then the innovation side is everything related to what I would call the R&D of the bank. So we really develop research, do research and develop new products, which we also launch. And if it's successful, we also scale, but we scale them then always within our client units. So we are not a startup factory which tries to create the next startup for ABN AMRO, which we then can sell off. We really are focusing on developing new products and services for the bank. And to do that, we also really want to be connected with the outside world. So everything we do in terms of investments in startups, but also helping very young startups together with the young startups with Techstars and the more, slightly more mature investments with Motif is also part of my remit.
Great. So then to maybe talk about that more specifically about the strategy of the bank when it comes to indeed investing in these startups, because that was one of my questions, is what is the goal that you have? Is it specifically focused on the bank or selling it, where you just said it's mainly focused on developing new products for the banks?
Yep.
Right? The areas you're heavily investing in now, as far as I know, is mainly within Gen AI, or AI, and fintech, right? That's where a lot is happening at the minute, or what we'll talk about maybe a bit more today. That's maybe because there's AI, Gen AI, we just spoke about chatbots as well. To before we dive into that Gen AI and what the bank does with that specifically, can you explain what the difference is between AI and Gen AI?
Yeah, I think if you look at more the history, right, it started with the more simple analytics. Then we got to machine learning, where the machine was understanding much more. Then you actually got more the whole neural networks, which were able to absorb more data, but also more aspects of certain data types. And now we are more in what I would call generic models. And I think what major difference is, if I look more from an end user perspective, is that in the previous models, the models were always very narrow in terms of their application. So you had a model which could play chess, you had a model which could play Go, you can, and a model which could recognize pictures, etc. And what you now have with these generic language models, you actually have them not only as to generate text, but you can generate photos, you can do a lot of content generation, but also with completely different use cases. Right, so with the same module, you can write your Santa Claus poem, but you can also write code with it. And I think that's the major difference is in the application side, that we now have one model which has so many different types of usage, given the technology which is behind it, compared to where the previous versions of AI, and they all have their right of existence because one model is always very good to solve a certain issue. But the sheer size of types of applications you can do with this is really mind-blowing. And that's what I would see as the major difference.
Do they exist next to each other then?
Or yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
That's absolutely, because their use cases are different. And I think if you look at the power of not only AI, but automation in general, where AI plays a role, it's actually about the power. You really get the power and the impact if you're able to combine different types of technologies. I will give a couple of examples later on, but the whole idea is if you really want to create, let's say, the 1,000 different agents you can create using Gen AI, you will have maybe also a transcriptor in it, right? Or just does speech to text. You will have maybe a simple workflow tool, or you will simply have a tool which connects you to 1,000 APIs. And it's all about using the technology where it's strong and for the rest integrated then with another technology which has another strength. And in my mind, all these things will coexist. What we also try to do here is always pick the most simple model which is right for the job. We're not always on the latest version of, for instance, ChatGPT, because sometimes 3.5 Turbo is good enough.
Yeah.
But also, we sometimes use simple machine learning instead of a neural network because it's good enough. So it's always good from a maintenance perspective, but also, okay, to what extent can you explain outcomes, etc., to keep it as simple as appropriate for the use case you're looking at.
Berlin presents the new highlight in the financial sector, FIBE, the FinTech and Finance Festival for the global stage. On April 24 and 25, this innovative format will celebrate its premiere at CityCube Berlin, organized by the Berlin Finance Initiative in cooperation with Handelsblatt and Messe Berlin. FIBE is aligned at the entire FinTech ecosystem in Europe, from up-and-coming FinTech startups and investors to established banks and political decision-makers. As the proud media partner for the event, we will also be recording a very special live episode of InCheck with FinTech at FIBE, so make sure to grab your discounted ticket now using the promo code FIBE_special, and we'll be looking forward to seeing you there.
Is it just in practical terms, if I, for example, an AI model for customer service or a Gen AI model customer service, if I ask it the same question, would I get two different answers?
You would get two different answers if I would say, let's use a very simple machine learning trained chatbot on the same topic as I would train a Gen AI application, the Gen AI would definitely give a better answer.
Yeah, because it's limited by the resources which it's fed.
But also, by the way, it expresses itself. So typically, if you see a chatbot, the chatbot will give you a menu.
Yeah.
And why will it give you a menu? Because the level of understanding your intent is way more limited. Right? So that it already starts with the intent recognition, which is typically worse. And also then the versatility to actually use a language. And typically, I mean, humans are hard to comprehend. Right. So when I went live with my first client, with Amelia, we thought, oh, we will hit very high levels of understanding. I can tell you, Amelia barely understood anything. And we made the classic mistake. Again, this was our very, very first implementation, but we made the classic mistake to ask experts, what will people ask?
Yeah.
And they said, they will ask, how can I stop my policy, for instance. But people were not asking this. People were asking questions like, I just broke up with my boyfriend and he was always driving my car. And actually all the claims from the last 3 years were because of my boyfriend, because I never had an accident. He's obviously not using my car anymore. So can I now have a lower premium? Try to classify that.
Yeah, right. Right.
And that's a Gen AI tool will do a way, way better job than a machine learning model on this specific one. And this is how people think, work, frame. And maybe if you look at yourself, at least when I talk with the chatbot, I dummy down actually how I'm talking to the chatbot. I'm already, right, talking way more in simpler language in the hope that the chatbot will understand me, which is obviously wrong. And that's with Gen AI, you don't need to do that anymore.
That's probably because of your history with AI and chatbots.
I think in practice, if you watch yourself next time, you'll probably know
what you're going to tell us. Well, you're right. Yeah. When you were saying it, I was like, yeah, that does sound very much like me, where you're thinking, okay, I'm talking to a robot, so I must make myself super understandable in order for the chatbot or the AI bot or the Gen AI bot, which I don't know right then and there what it is.
Exactly. To be specific. And at one moment, you figure out how intelligent it is, and then you sort of can adapt again. But typically, people are disappointed in chatbots. So,
It's also getting used to this, right, with Gen AI. With ChatGPT, I speak to it as if it is a human saying please and thank you. Because not just necessarily because I think I speak to a robot and I want to be polite or feel it's a human, but also because I'm not sure how it will communicate with me if I'm not going to be nice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's actually a good one. I never thought about that one. But yeah, that's absolutely correct. Yeah,
it's funny. But yeah, I mean, the hype around Gen AI is obviously used. I think I read an article on the Times where they were talking about Gen AI investment will reach $85 billion in 2030, whereas they expect only $6 billion in 2024. So that's 1,400% in growth, which is
huge.
And then I read somewhere else that I think 75% of banking executives believe their industry is set to be significantly impacted by emerging technology. How significant does ABN think is going to be? A bit of a rhetoric question, still, I'm curious.
I can only also say now I think when I think we follow this very closely, and obviously we have also looked at where will it impact and also how big is the impact. Now, and if you look at it, the interesting thing is, also coming back to my previous answer, you can apply it anywhere in a bank or anywhere in a financial institution or a governmental institution as well. So it's not specifically to bank. Everywhere where you have a lot of administrative processes, a lot of data, it can be very, very powerful. What we also see is that it's always about a fraction of a task of someone. And typically it's a fraction of the task you can automate, which is not as much value adding as some of the other parts, right? So if you take a call center agent, they want to have that job because they love the client interaction. And what we actually are taking away is some of the admin and easiness of search and these type of things. So what we see so far is that it enables us to put people much more in their strength and much more in the heart of the role they actually provide or fulfill within the bank.
Yeah, I think I heard you talking on another podcast that it's instead of hearing the typing from a customer service agent, you will now have the Gen AI, which will hear the person talking, can immediately start to search for what might be necessary problems, and then the agent come up with the solutions whilst adding, obviously, their personal touch
exactly
to it all. Because that is, you feel, is never going to be replaced by Gen AI, or do you think there's a few? Are we in danger of Gen AI taking over at some point? It's maybe an extended question.
No. I don't think so. Right. So when I was at Amedia, this was sort of the first AI hype in years again. And also then people were asking me, will jobs be replaced, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And we actually have now a labor shortage in the market. So I think, obviously, the jobs will dramatically change. That's for sure. Everyone's job will change. For some people, it's only 20% of the job. For some people, it will be 60% of the job, but it will definitely change.
Yeah.
Some jobs we will be able to automate. However, there will also be new jobs, which didn't exist. So when I was at Amelia, actually, I discovered there were hairstylists for avatars, believe it or not.
Uh-huh.
Now, with the current technology, you barely need them anymore because it's not much better created by computers. But there will be new jobs, obviously, as well, like the job prompt engineer didn't exist 2 or 3 years ago, just to give you an example. The other thing is, if you look at the trend and if you look at, for instance, our economy, the Dutch economy, we actually need to dramatically increase our population because we will have less people being able to work because we're generally getting older. So we actually need technology to keep up the productivity levels and maybe even to help us with the next productivity leap to also help us to keep society just running.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's also other needs where so we might also say it's a necessity unless we all want to work until we're 80 or something. So
I guess automation can fill gaps where other new, not sure where I'm going with this. Automation can potentially take work away, which then these people who are doing that work can replace other work. What I'm trying to get at is, for example...
No, you will probably need to do some massive reschooling for this. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
So because we might maybe need less people in industry A or B, and we might need more people in healthcare. So then you have to re-educate people towards, let's say, healthcare.
Exactly.
Or towards becoming a teacher. So that's something which we need to do, and hopefully also that there's something society and also the government will help with these type of transitions. Will it be all next year? No, for sure not. I mean, these things are going gradual, but if you look 10 years from now back, or maybe even 8 years, 5 years back, we probably have seen these type of shift. Yeah.
Yes, I'm curious to talk a bit more about the societal impact, but maybe from a bank point of view, where does the bank think that their most wins will be had when it comes to or with the technology of Gen AI?
I can talk a little bit about the different types of use cases and then sort of link that to a win because it's such a broader scope. But we have a couple of areas where we're focusing on. So we do voice.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with voice. And voice is helping our call center agents mainly, but also our advisors who are talking with clients. It's basically anywhere where we have interactions with our clients. We are the furthest ahead with the implementation in the call center. And what we do there is, which actually already summarized perfectly, calls are coming in, we transcribe them. We actually then also help looking automatically for the right information to solve basically the question, and we write the summaries. What we're currently doing as well is, we are now in an experiment with actually providing also feedback about the conversation itself to see where can next time an agent or the bank in general even be better in the customer conversation. So we're slowly trying to see how much we can stretch sort of the scope of what we do there. But everything is focusing on making actually our call center agents our heroes towards the client. And that's sort of what we aim for. To help the client better, to help the client also hopefully a bit faster, but maybe better. And also that it doesn't matter who picks up the phone. It should not matter if someone already works for 2 years in a call center and someone who only works for 2 months in a call center. You should have similar type of experience. Probably a person who's already here for 2 years will use the technology much less, and the technology will actually then be much more used by the people who are younger in the call center. Or shorter in the call center. So that's on voice. And then we can have the same application of the voice logic when we do a video meeting. Right? And in the end, you can imagine if there's a video meeting, there are other things we can watch as well. We don't do that, but the technology is there. There also, we mainly look at also more the content which is exchanged and all kinds of other conversations we have with clients as well. So there's a lot of things on voice, but what you hear is, and you will hear that with all the use cases, it's all augmentation of people. And that's so it's not yet the Gen AI talking directly with our clients. It's all, there's always a human in between. Mm-hmm. Now, the second one, and I already integrated that a little bit in the first one, is the knowledge search. So really trying to find the right knowledge within the bank. And as you know, we have many products, many procedures. You might be stuck on step 3 in a mortgage approval trajectory or whatsoever. But the good news is we have all these processes and all these products extremely well documented. That's a big advantage of us as a regulated institution. Everything is documented. So having then AI looking at those documents and helping me to find the right document, but also try to find the right answer within the document. That's actually what we do. Obviously, when you do this, there are also lots of internal processes. I'm a manager and I'm going to hire for the first time a new employee. How do I do this? Or I want to have a leasing bike as part of my salary. How do I do this? So also all these internal types of processes, same technology, same logic, but then more with an internal one. Now, on the internal ones, there we actually expose more and more our employees directly to the technology because it's an internal process.
Yeah.
But when it's with the client, again, there's always the human in between. Then the other category, we go a bit further. Then we say, okay, but we have our standard knowledge, but there's all kinds of other documents, especially for older loans and these type of things, but also in corporate processes, there's still way more paperwork than what you and I as a consumer from a bank are used to. And that is more getting intelligence out of the documents, which are more part of a workflow. A document which is, for instance, about the house written by a notary. There's all kinds of data in there. So can we automatically not get the data out of the document instead of looking at it and retyping it? So it's having much more intelligence on recognizing those data points. Now, here's becoming very interesting because you can say, yeah, that Gen AI could do it. But what we also see is that Gen AI is sometimes also not enough. You need really much more a history and a taxonomy based on that history. And this is, for instance, where startups come in. Right? So here we're really looking at, can we do this completely ourselves or do we need to have specialized startups who have maybe still from their old models, but they have the taxonomy so that we can compare not only what the JI says, but also we can use a bit more the traditional taxonomies, given the fact that this is sometimes really about very small details, which can make a huge difference. So here, this is still more in the experimental phase, and here we're still figuring out what to do. What we're also experimenting with, and I think everyone is doing that, and there are some more what I would call AI inside type of products. And this is what typically are called the co-pilots. Now, we're experimenting with the co-pilots more as part of Office 365, a bit more intelligence behind the PowerPoint and the Words of this world. And the same thing also with coding.
Mm-hmm.
So we're also looking at, how can we make coding more productive? And people will say, oh, AI will take over coding. We don't think so, but it will definitely help to get you started. It will definitely help maybe to enrich code you've written yourself. So there are many of these interesting use cases. But also, let's not forget that a large part of the work of a coder is actually to understand, does the code actually fit the needs of what my colleagues need or what the end client needs? So it might help with becoming more productive on one part of the job, but there's many other elements as well where you still will need humans to do this. So those are the elements. Obviously, we're also more looking ahead, a bit more looking forward. How can a next generation chatbot actually look like? A couple of these things as well. But this is, in a nutshell, a bit more how we categorize the different use cases for now.
Interesting. So in summary, it's the personalization enhancement, is the digitization of paper-based products, and it's the co-pilot. It seems like it's a nice balance between cost saving that you hope to get out of Gen AI versus innovation.
Yeah.
Was that fair to say?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot about innovation, but also really a lot about the customer experience.
Yeah.
I think in the end, right, a lot of these things can help us to focus much more on what our clients need. And because there's a lot of admin which distracts people in general, matter if you're at a bank or at any other institution, which distracts people from the thing we're actually hired to do, and that is help our clients. So and that's sort of where we see a lot of potential.
Do you think that if you look ahead, also on the society as a whole, these, in light of today with what happened in the last year with the boom of Gen AI, OpenAI obviously being a big part of that, and how it has reframed our thinking about Gen AI. I think these seem like the first steps towards the use of Gen AI. What do you think the societal impact can be of Gen AI moving forward?
I think it's huge. I think it's since the iPhone, the first new technology, which actually is discussed during dinner in a family situation.
Yeah.
Right. So my kids are using it, right? So even my parents try to use it a bit. So, I mean, it's again a very big step up, I think, for everyone. And everyone will need to adapt. So schools need to adapt on, how do we give homework? Do we actually allow our students to use it or not? So there's on all kinds of fronts. There's huge impact, and the speed with which this came is significantly faster.
I think you also are now the member of the board of advisors for the AI for the Planet.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that there's also potentially an impact. Or how do you see the impact on the environment with Gen AI? What do you think?
Yeah, that's a good one, because on the one hand, it's creating all these models and also using them is enormous in compute power, and by definition, therefore, also very polluting.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the other hand, it helps us to solve issues which we cannot solve without it. And we actually have very big issues to solve with each other to actually make the Earth a much more greener and safer place. So, it's not one or the other. I think we have to learn to live with it. And also, I'm convinced that the models actually will get again, more energy efficient. So there's quite a few startups who have that as their mantra. We can make those models with less data and therefore much more environmental friendly. On the other hand, if you look at the world where we need to create, we cannot do that without further automation as well. So if we want to travel less, there will be more video.
Yeah.
But also if we want to have houses off the grid, which sometimes get energy still from the grid, sometimes deliver back, where we maybe even need technology to micromanage when I charge the car versus when I do the dishwasher, et cetera, et cetera. You can't do that without AI and models. That's a very simple example. Now, try to do this at scale. So we need the technology as well to overcome some of the significant challenges we have on climate. We need better models as well to predict when there are storms, when the storms become more severe. So there's all kinds of examples which just show us that the technology, from that perspective, might also come at the right time to help us to see if we can not completely innovate ourselves out of the problems we have, because that's probably not completely doable, but at least help us to make a big step.
I mean, the applicability is far and wide, I think, right? Especially looking ahead. Yep. What do you think is the biggest hurdle to overcome in order to make sure that this is going to be applied or going to be used, I guess, in the right way, and that we're going to get everything out of it?
People.
Interesting.
It's not the technology. It's always about people. And it's, I think, about, this still requires a lot of dialogue, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I'm very enthusiastic about the technology, but I also see that there's a need for guardrails within which you can develop use cases, but also in which you can develop the technology itself. So with the AI Act, I'm actually quite happy with it. I think actually it's good that the government is trying, right, to keep up with the technology and to make sure that we develop in a very responsible way this technology, and especially the usage of this technology. So from that perspective, I think going forward, right, humans will have still lots of creativity to find all kinds of solutions and use cases, but let's make sure that we do this to make society truly better, right? And also to keep it also a bit in balance in terms of where the balance of powers are, because you already see with the whole movement to cloud, to big platforms, that it's actually not completely evenly distributed, and that in Europe we're mainly users and not this much creators of these type of technologies. It's very funny, we're in the Netherlands at the forefront of all the amazing chips and the machines who can make the chip technology to make this all work, and then it's sort of And then there's a huge gap, and then we're very good in adopting it again, right? And I hope within Europe we can feel that.
Debbie, I think to your point about the AI Act, it must be difficult to come up with regulation around something that is so, I guess, hard to fathom completely what the potential is with it, to make sure that you get the most out of it versus making sure that it's also not going to harm anything that it could potentially harm.
Yep.
Because there's a lot of critics as well about Gen AI, right? That say it's dangerous, it will take over the world, it will take over humankind. I mean, some might say they are more the doomsayers, but is there an element of fear to you as well with what is happening in Gen AI, or do you only look at the positive sides of
the well, the glass is typically half full for me, so,
okay.
So we'll be aware of that. I think... and I'm coming back to what I said in the beginning, the power, but therefore also potentially the danger, is not purely in Gen AI. It's again combining different types of technologies to create something great, but you can also combine different types of technologies to create something completely scary. And obviously we've now created a very powerful element which can be combined with some other technologies, and that's something, obviously, is a danger. Like, right? I mean, who would have imagined the size of cybercrime when the internet was invented? And so we have to deal with it. And unfortunately, I don't think we can stop it, even if we would freeze now. And what Elon Musk and others sometimes say, it's there. So we cannot stop it. And there's open source and there's all kinds of other things. So I think what I like is that like there is this regulation, and I hope the government will keep on focusing on and improving it, also more from a learning perspective, that they will make it better so that, A, we can stay competitive on one hand with Europe, but on the other hand also really protect our civilians and our basic human rights. And that's our sort of the thin line we have to...
I guess in the wrong hands, JDI can become a knife, in the right hands become a flower. I'm totally butchering something, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. It's actually, it will make a great t-shirt.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't it? Yeah. Great. I mean, ABN AMRO obviously does a lot as well with fintech and with technology as a whole. I think we can probably spend a whole another episode on that. So last question for me, specifically around JDI. Let's say it's not the beginning of 2024 recording this, right? If we sit down exactly a year from now, what do you think will have happened in this GenAI space? Or what are you working on with ABN that you can give us a sniff of that is exciting, as it's going to be groundbreaking or new?
No, I think what I really would like to see that a really large share of my colleagues are getting the help, some more than others really, by GenAI. I think that's sort of what I would think is very important, because I think then we can improve really our service towards our clients. But also what I think is very, very important is that in general, people understand the technology. And the only way to understand the technology is to work with it, because if we like it or not, it's part of our future. And it's important not only for yourself to know it, but obviously, we work with corporates, we work with small entrepreneurs, right? So also to be able to talk with them about this technology and what it could mean for them, and also why it's important for them to work with it. That's also a bit the role of the bank, but you can only do that when you experience it yourself. So that would be, for me, the aim. Will you see revolution in 2024? I don't think so, because we are still also, although we are scaling some of these use cases up, we're still in continuously having debates, okay, but how can we keep it secure? How can we ensure the privacy, et cetera, et cetera? So for us, it's also a learning, and we will always de-risk it when we're not sure, right? So, and that deeper determines really, really the speed, because in the end, banking is about trust. So although we love the technology and although we see the potential, we would never betray the trust-based relationship we have with our clients to push technology for the sake of pushing technology.
Can imagine. You know, you still have the banking environment or the banking box to think within, basically. But from what I take away from you is that it will enhance kind of the people in GenAI technology.
Yeah. And therefore, since my banking is largely a people business, directly and indirectly, it will help our clients.
On that note, thanks, Edwin. Great to have you on the show.
Yep.
Great to hear your thoughts. And let's talk on a new episode about all your fintech initiatives.
That will be great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of In Check with Fintech. If you liked what you heard, rate our podcast on Spotify and follow us to get updated with our latest episodes. Are you looking for some exclusive content? Then don't forget to follow our LinkedIn page, PCN, and check out our website, teampcn.com.